Hey, before we get started with Off Camera today, I want to share with you a very special new feature at our website, offcamera.com. As you probably know, Off Camera is a television show as well. But did you know that you could watch whole episodes online right on our website? And now we're making that even easier with a monthly subscription to Off Camera. For only $4.99 a month, you can experience Off Camera in glorious black and white and watch what you've been listening to. Buying a subscription is a great way to support the show and also a great way to binge watch some of your favorite conversations. So go to offcamera.com and get a monthly subscription to our show. We'll be glad you did, and so will you. Now on to the show. Hey folks, Sam Jones here. Welcome to another edition of Off Camera, the show where I get to talk to iconic, creative, curious artists and find out how they got that way. In this episode, I sit down with singer, songwriter, podcaster, and Foo Fighters lead guitarist, Chris Shiflett. As you can imagine, I listen to a lot of podcasts, and one of my favorites, Walking the Floor, is hosted by my good friend, Chris Shiflett, which dives deep into alternative country music, songwriting, and the business of making records. Actually, I think Chris and I both do podcasts for the same selfish reason. We want to know how the best artists in the business do what they do. With 18 years as the Foo Fighters lead guitarist and a fascinating solo career, it's time for Chris to answer that question himself. With a house full of records and rock-loving brothers, it's no surprise Chris picked up a guitar at 11 in an attempt to become Ace Frehley. What he became was a high school dropout who moved to LA to make it in a band. He did the van tour circuit with several punk acts before getting the life-changing Foo's audition. But here's the thing about Chris. Now in a position to enjoy private planes, deluxe riders, and a very nice life, he doesn't take it for granted, nor does he rest on his stadium-filling laurels. He digs deep into the music that interests him and isn't above taking a songwriting class or climbing back in the van as he tours around the country with his own music. Chris shares his story, his unique perspective on the music business, and why the best country lyrics don't always earn a thumbs up from your wife. So pull up a chair and listen in. Yo, Chris.
Sam Jones.
You know, I would say thanks for coming, but you're sort of hanging around here a lot anyway. I mean, full disclosure to the audience, they should know that we've known each other a long time. We're friends. Yes. We have kids in school together.
Yes, indeed.
We've played music together.
We skate together. We still have to make that skateboarding, that middle-aged dad skateboard podcast.
I know.
Yeah,
we just
one
have
of these days.
We have to pad up and get our health insurance in order.
One of these days.
But, you know, it's funny. I started thinking about, well, what am I going to ask him to make it authentic and it's
right.
not rehashing
that you
what
don't
we already know.
Know?
But the truth is, I don't know a lot. And I think sometimes when you have friends that you do social things with, maybe you don't dig into their past or you assume a bunch of stuff, right? Like,
yeah.
I knew where you grew up, but I don't know the details. So I thought
sure.
we'd start there.
Sure.
And then I also want to talk about, you know, you've made a new record.
Yep.
You have a podcast.
Yes, sir.
You're the guitar player for the Foo Fighters, for anyone
Indeed.
Who doesn't know. But what I wanted to start with and what I admire about you is your work ethic. And I think that because we talk a lot at school and everything, I know that you go and shut yourself in your studio for hours at a time on a daily basis and you write, you record, you practice.
Yeah.
Which, to be honest, there's a lot of people at your age and position and at the level of band that you're in. They probably don't go practice. You know, they probably just do what they have to do.
Yeah.
And I'm very impressed with your work ethic. And
well,
I just
you.
Wondered if that was something that you've always had, if you got it from your parents.
Or... No, you know, it's funny. I think about my childhood a lot and I think about how much I lacked any work ethic at all.
Really?
Growing up, yeah, I was a terrible student. I was a terrible guitar student. I never practiced. Ever.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, I would never learn my guitar lesson until it'd be like 10 minutes before my mom was going to take me to my guitar lesson. But, oh my God, I have to learn what those Beatles chords that, you know, I was supposed to learn this week or whatever. It wasn't until I started playing in bands in high school that I really started to play a lot. I mean, I really started playing guitar mostly because I love music and I had older brothers that were both musicians and both, you know, really into music. And so it just seemed like sort of the natural thing to do.
So you have two older brothers?
I have two older brothers. My older brother, Mike, plays guitar and teaches, actually, at the shop that we all learned how to play guitar at.
Really?
Yeah, yeah. And then
In Santa Barbara?
In Santa Barbara, yeah, where I grew up. And then my middle brother, Scott, started on bass, and he's an incredible bass player. He plays bass in a band called Face to Face, but he's also an amazing guitar player, and sort of always was. Scott was the guy that just was good at any instrument he ever picked up.
It's fascinating that all three of you ended up playing guitar. Did either of your parents play?
No. Now, my dad was really into music.
He was.
He loved music. It was really, I think my dad probably passed that on to my older brother, Mike. And Mike passed it on to Scott. And Mike and Scott passed it on to me. We just always had records, you know. I didn't even really start buying records till probably I was in junior high or right around that age. Because I just had my brother's record collections.
God, it just seems like it was your provenance to end up playing the guitar.
Well, it was kind of like, for us, it was like we weren't into sports. We weren't good at school. We didn't care about anything but music. Music, you know, at that time, like, I don't see it with my kids. I don't think it's the same way anymore. But back then, like, you were really defined by the bands that you were in. You know, so we were into, like, hard rock and classic rock and heavy metal and stuff like that. And then even within that, you'd be like, I'm into Kiss. Kiss is better than AC/DC or what, you know, that sort of stuff, you know.
What was the first band that really defined you?
Well, my early memories are like the Stones and the Beatles and stuff like that. But the first band that I really like
your band.
My band was Kiss.
It was.
Oh yeah, yeah. I was a little kid. They had Makeup, Fire, Blood, you know.
Yeah.
Smoke. It was crazy sounding.
Did you ever do Kiss for Halloween or?
Oh yeah.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Oh, many times. I remember my dad. And this wasn't even on Halloween, but I remember having my dad paint Gene Simmons' makeup on me, and he was really uncomfortable, like, getting it all close to the eye, and then I just...
Probably didn't have a lot of experience.
No, I don't think he did, but then he just said, you know, I just kind of walked around my neighborhood, like, I don't know why.
But that's what we did before phones and...
Totally.
TV and...
Yeah. Yeah. My kids will never have that because they've got iPhones.
You know, I never saw Kiss. I was into Kiss and never got to see them.
What's the beauty of the whole look and everything. You could go see him right now. It's probably like better than it was in 1978, you know?
Sure.
Yeah.
Oh, I used to stare at the Kiss Alive cover.
Oh, yeah.
I didn't even notice for the first 3 or 4 years that there was like nothing plugged in.
Well,
I was like, that's mid-concert.
I don't know if I've noticed that yet. I don't know if I've noticed until you just mentioned that. But no, totally. I mean, do you remember like being a kid, you would just stare at the album sleeve.
Yeah.
And you just knew every detail. I remember like going like, what does mixing mean?
Oh, I would look at the Casablanca logo and go like, are these
records
made in Egypt?
You just look for clues and everything,
yeah.
You know?
Yeah. And then who are these other people? Like if you read closely on the songwriting credits.
You're right. Right.
There's other people.
I know.
You're like, who are
what are they doing?
Yeah.
And why?
Oh, how innocent we were.
Yeah. Definitely.
So when did the shift happen and you got serious about music?
Well, I remember there was a summer between 8th and 9th grade that one of my good friends had moved down to LA. With his family, and I came to visit him, and it was right at that time the sort of LA glam rock stuff was bubbling up, and we walked around all over Melrose. I remember getting a bunch of flyers and like, you know, Poison flyers and Guns N' Roses flyers and stuff like that, and that was like that. I remember that week was like when it really hit me, like, this is what I want to do for my life. It was like the first time I saw that, like, you know, that there was this scene that, you know, I don't know why it seemed accessible at the time, but it was. And me and my friends had this plan that I was going to, when I graduated high school, I was going to move to LA and we're going to put a band together and, you know, make it. And they even said, and so they said, oh, you know, when you get back, because I was a terrible guitar player, I couldn't play at all at that point. It was like, you know, between 8th and 9th grade. And they said, when you get back up to Santa Barbara, you got to go take guitar lessons from this guy, Steve Miles, and he'll teach you how to play, like, lead guitar. And I remember, like, vividly, he showed me, like, my first, like, lead lick. You know, how to go, like, willy, 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 willy. I was like, I got it.
Done.
I'm good. Yeah.
No, but did you still, at that point, did you start practicing? And
well, that's when I started really playing in bands. You know, and in high school, it just seemed like there were a million bands around. You know, everybody had a band. And so there's me and my friends had our band, and there was, you know, then I was in a couple other short-lived bands, and then one point I was in this one band. We had our band called Lost Kittens, and then I joined this other band called Rat Pack that were with some older guys, and that was a little more, you know, they kind of had a following, like they had a 7-inch out on Mystic Records and stuff like that. And just as the years went by in high school, it's no coincidence that the more I was playing, you know, my schoolwork was just doing this at the exact same time.
Really?
Yeah, yeah. And then, you know, eventually I dropped out of high school.
Oh, you did?
Yeah.
How far did you go in high school?
I made it till the very beginning of 12th grade.
Really?
But I was so far behind and had already gone to, like, the, you know, the sort of secondary school or whatever you call it, you know, for the kids that don't do their homework. And then they moved, and that school was way out in Goleta, and I went to it with the notion that I was going to catch up.
Right.
You know, but it was so much easier to not go. It was a disaster. And then they moved that school back to the campus of my actual high school, but you were in these little, like, trailers down the hill.
So were you a bit ostracized, or was there a label on you as you're in that group?
Well, there was to me. You know, because all my friends were going to the regular high school, and I was not going to walk down that hill every day and go to the little trailer for the ding-dongs, because I had joined the group of ding-dongs, you know. So I remember I went the first day, and I was just like, nope, dropping out. And that's, it's funny, you know, you ask about, or you talked about me having a good work ethic and everything, and I didn't up until that point, but then I dropped out of high school, and I just got a job.
What'd you do?
Well, I got a couple of different jobs. I worked at a coffee shop for a little while. I worked at, I had a terrible job at this base manufacturer that was up in Santa Barbara, where I was the low man on the totem pole and would have to buff these bases on this big spinning wheel. You know, these three spinning wheels of, I don't even remember how it all worked, but I was terrible at it. And I would sit there all day long with this thing spinning a million miles an hour, and it would catch on the where the pickups are routed out and smash the thing against the wall, and I'd like pick it up and bury it in a box and hope nobody noticed. And then eventually, after kind of doing all that, those kind of jobs for a while, my mom said, my mom was a probation officer.
Okay, so wait a minute.
My mom was a probation officer, yeah.
And you drop out of high school.
Yes, she was not pleased.
How did that go over?
Not well, yeah. She wasn't real pumped about it. I mean, you know. What parent would be happy when their kid drops out?
But did your older brothers drop out, or did they go?
We all dropped out.
You did?
An entire family.
When you guys do something, you do it all together.
We didn't form a band, but we did all drop out together. So yeah, I think that my brothers had smoothed the way.
God, I wonder how your mom felt if she felt like, oh, I have three creative geniuses who are going to find their way.
I don't think she felt that way. but the funny thing was, okay, so my mom, you know, said, you're going to go get a job at the probation department. And she had talked to, you know, one of her coworkers that arranged for me to get a job there. And then I was, like, working down the street from my school, which was way harder than, I could have just gone to high school, you know.
And you had a probation like facility,
which was funny because I would see my friends in there, you know, would be on probation, and then, you know, and I my job was in the records room. This is no joke. I was in the records room, so when I would have time on my hands, I'd be like, I wonder what Matt Ratt's been arrested for. Let's have a look. And I'd just go pull their file. Oh, really?
So your mom at this point must have thought, like, I've raised three ding-dongs.
Totally. It was many years till she didn't feel that way, I'm sure. Yeah. I mean, really, it wasn't until I joined the Foo Fighters that I think my parents were really okay with my life choices.
Yeah. You know? Well, I wondered what you learned about your character from being in bands.
It's funny. So the probation department gig was a good thing because that's how I saved up money to move to L.A. I got that job when I turned 18, which was in 1989. And I worked, you know, most of that year. I saved up enough money to buy a new amp and move to L.A. So I moved to L.A. in January of 1990 with one of my best friends. And we had grown up going.
Did you move to, like, the Sunset Strip?
I moved into a terrible little apartment right off of Hollywood Boulevard, right by the Playboy Liquor.
Really?
Which is kind of a trendy neighborhood now, but I assure you it was not at that time.
Yeah?
Yeah, it was pretty scary. But it was great. I mean, we loved it. We were so happy just to be, you know, we were 18, like, woo, we're in the big city. But when we moved at the beginning of 1990, it was in that weird post-Guns N' Roses getting huge, pre, you know, alternative music,
grunge.
Pre-Nirvana.
Yeah,
you know,
exactly. Kinda,
it was that weird in-between time when the scene in L.A. was just dead. It was dead. So we moved down here, like, thinking, our rock bands, we're in this rock and roll band, we're going to get gobbled up by a major label, and, you know, all our dreams are going to come true. And it was just, like, crickets, you know, just no scene. It was dead.
Wow.
To be honest, I didn't really care that much because I was having so much fun just being a kid living in LA and going out every night. But it was a little like deflating to realize, wait, this thing that I've been, you know, moving towards for all these years, it just doesn't exist anymore. It was gone.
So do you have a job in LA?
Oh, yeah. No, I always had a job.
You did?
But I just had some terrible office job. It's funny, the probation department, I hate to keep going back to that, but that set me on this career path of low-end office work.
Like low-end government level.
Yeah, like a life of, you know.
God, think about how your life was this close to me seeing you at the DMV.
Yes, totally.
God.
That could have been me.
Did you have some sort of a plan B or a, I don't know, some kind of time limit of, or a any kind of plan?
No. I mean, periodically, I remember there was this brief moment in 1991, you know, after I'd lived in LA for, you know, barely a year and a half or something. And I decided, because my boss at the time, who was the greatest boss I ever had, such a great, he was kind of a second dad to me in a lot of ways. He said, hey, you know, I'll pay for you to go to take some classes, you know, at City College if you want, you know. And so he said, take some accounting classes at Pierce College. And so I thought, you know what, I'm going to become an accountant. And I moved to Sherman Oaks, moved out to the Valley with my girlfriend, and started taking classes out there. And that lasted like 2 months or something.
Yeah.
I mean, it just like really quickly, I just went, I don't even remember thinking about it. I just didn't do it. You know, I signed up. I went, this is like the story of my life for a long time. Like, great idea. Go try to do the right thing. Sign up for it. Go a couple of times. And then just kind of, there's something shiny over there. And, you know.
But thank God you weren't good at bookkeeping. Or it didn't, you know, grab you. Because that'd be horrible.
Well, yeah, the bookkeeping thing didn't work out. You know, me and my girlfriend broke up. I wound up moving back over the hill into Hollywood. And you know, played in bands around town for years. And, you know, I was like always in bands that you get like A&R people would come out and check your band up, but never got a record deal or anything. I look back, it kind of makes me laugh now because like everybody got record deals back then.
I know,
and somehow like I never was in a band that could muster a record deal, you know. But I did that for a few years and then moved up to San Francisco and got a job at Fat Records. And then that led to me getting the gig with a band that was on Fat Records.
No Use for a Name.
No Use for a Name, yeah. And that was the first time I was ever in a band that made records, went on tour. You know, they had a draw. It was like I could, you know, support myself most of the time.
So did you have a different attitude going on the road in a van than a lot of the people that had done it for a while?
Oh, dude, I was the happiest guy in the world. Yeah, and actually my first tour was as a roadie. So many of my friends were in these bands that were going out on tour, and I was so jealous. It's just like, I don't care how I get out. I just want to go on the road. I'll hump gear, you know?
Right.
That's fine. And then just a few months later, I did that tour. I came back. I moved to San Francisco. I was up there for maybe a month or so and wound up getting the gig in No Use and then left on tour, you know, a few days later.
And how long were you in that band?
I was in No Use for about 4.5 years.
Oh, wow. So at that point, describe your life when you're doing that. Was that sort of as far as you'd imagined it in terms of, like, I've made it?
Well, it's funny because, yeah, it was. I mean, you talk about having a backup plan. That was when I began to think about maybe having a backup plan. My life was great. I loved it. I mean, it was really the first time that I had that life was pretty carefree. Most of the time, I didn't have to have a job. I was touring a lot and working and playing in a couple of different bands because I was also in another band called 22 Jacks for a little while that was working when No Use wasn't. And then we put together Me First and the Gimme Gimmes and started recording those records. And that wasn't really a touring thing back then, but, you know, we were making records. And, you know, the punk rock scene, like the Fat Records world was just on fire back then. And so all of a sudden, I went from, like, in crazy debt and broke and couldn't pay rent to like I'd you know, made a couple Gimme's records, made a couple No Use records, had done a bunch of touring, and it's all of a sudden like kind of pulling it, you know?
Right.
Like, life was pretty good. But that was when I also started thinking about, you know, like there were some, like I love the No Use guys and it was a great experience, but there were definitely some frustrating things with you know, like Tony, our singer, had like a fear of flying that, you know, at the time, like now I look back and go, God, I was kind of a dick about how I handled that, you know, because that's a real thing. It's an irrational phobia, and you can't really blame a guy for not wanting to get on a plane if he's uncomfortable with it. But at the time, I was just like, you know, really frustrated because we couldn't go to Japan, we couldn't go to South America, we couldn't go to Australia, and all, you know, all our friends were doing all this stuff. So I hit a point, we'd canceled a couple Japanese tours, and I'd hit a point where I was starting to think about, like, you know, maybe this has gone as far as it's going to go for me, and maybe
so that's what you think about a plan,
right? And so this was in '99. This was right before I got the gig in the Foo Fighters, and I remember we were off the road. I think we were maybe working on a record. I went to San Francisco City College one semester, and I took four classes. It was the first time I
ever. Please tell me what those classes were.
It was the basics. It was like basic math, basic English,
right?
And I loved it. It was great. It was so fun. I got a 4.0, man. I got straight A's.
You're
I just totally applied myself for the first time ever. And then
What was your mom's reaction to that 4.0?
I don't know if I ever even told her. I mean, maybe she'll have to watch this to find out. Because I remember I was having this conversation with a buddy of mine who was up there going to college, and I was kind of going like, man, I really want to go to school, and you know, I really regret dropping out of high school, and you know, I just can't do it because I'm in this band and blah, blah. And he was like, what do you mean? Why can't you do it? Just do it. Sign up. Just go to school.
Right.
I was like, huh? And I did it. And that was great. And so I was starting to think about, you know, maybe doing something else, maybe going back to school. My dad had always told me it was an open offer. You know, I could come live with him. He lived out in the middle of nowhere, but I could come live with him and go to school or whatever. And so sort of those thoughts, I don't know if I would have done that or not, but, you know, I was starting to have those. Those thoughts were starting to slip in.
Right.
And then that summer, I got the opportunity to try out for the Foo Fighters. And
now, how did that happen?
It's funny. My buddy Bill, who's one of my closest friends, he called me one day and said, and I've told this story, and it has become like an internet myth, so I just want to clear this up right now. So he called me and said, hey, I think I could get you an audition with Guns N' Roses. And I was like, hey, man, see if you can get me an audition with the Foo Fighters. I heard that their guitar player quit. So I just want to make that clear that I was never asked to join Guns N' Roses, because I get asked that all the time. Hey, weren't you in Guns N' Roses? Or like, people like have totally misunderstood that story.
So that's amazing that you got asked to join Guns N' Roses, and you turned it down.
To join the Foo Fighters, yeah. So anyway, so Bill looked into that.
So he had connections.
Well, he knew this woman that is actually now my lawyer, who worked at the time at the law firm that represented the Foo Fighters, and she wound up getting my name on the list of the audition list. And so a couple
months. Was it a big list? Like,
I think it was 30, 40 people or something like
that.
Oh,
wow.
You know, yeah. So a couple months went by, and I got a phone call from Gus, who is still our tour manager, predates me in the organization, and he was like, hey, this is Gus from, you know, Foo Fighters, and we're having auditions next week in LA, you know, you want to come audition? And of course I was like, yeah. Are you kidding? Prank caller. And so I flew home, and I just they sent me a cassette tape of which songs to learn.
Oh, cassette.
To show you how long ago this
really?
Was. Yeah, it wasn't even a CD, it was a cassette. And I just sat there and I learned as many songs. I loved the Foo Fighters. I mean, they were like, you know, one of my favorite bands anyway. And then I went down and auditioned.
And what was that like?
Well, it was a little stressful because I had just made a new record with No Use for a Name, and we were about to go on tour. The record wasn't out yet, but we had a tour planned, and we were getting ready to go. So I was being kind of sneaky, and I couldn't tell my band, you know, hey, I'm going to go audition for the Foo Fighters. So I was just kind of keeping that hush-hush. And I went down, auditioned the one time, you know.
So describe that. Who's in the room?
It was just the band.
Just the band.
I had never met any of those cats before, so it was, you know, pretty nerve-wracking, but fun, super exciting.
Did they audition more than one person that day?
Well, yeah, because I got there a little bit early and stood outside listening to them audition somebody else. And then the music stopped, and then there was like 15 or 20 minutes of nothing. And I was sitting there going, fuck, they love this guy. This is the guy.
They're drinking beers right now.
Totally, yeah, they're all high-fiving each other and celebrating.
Someone's bringing a cake in. Congratulations.
And then I remember the guy walked out, and I remember thinking like, nah, that ain't the guy.
Really?
Yeah. And so I went in, and it was not. We didn't really even play that much. We just sort of, you know, talked a little bit, played a few songs. Dave was Dave. He was just funny, and you know, kind of bouncing around the room. And I was probably just like wide eyed, like,
yeah,
whoa, this is crazy. And that was that. And then I went home, and then they called me a week later and said, can you come down again? And And then that was a way more extensive.
Is that like callbacks?
That was like a callback. I got it a callback. Was. Yeah.
Did you wear the same thing?
No, but it's funny you said that because I did wear a very specific shirt to my first audition.
You did?
Maybe it was the second audition, but I definitely like, because like, you know, I knew that they had toured with Jawbreaker and I love Jawbreaker. So I wore like, I think I wore a Jawbreaker shirt. Maybe it was a Jets to Brazil shirt, which was Blake's band after Jawbreaker, thinking that that would like, you know, I'm one of you guys. I'm in the know. And nobody commented on it. So it just was, you know.
You're like, hey, guys.
I don't think that helped at all. But, yeah, so I came back down, jammed again. And then at the end of that, Dave was like, hey, come by the hotel, you know, later. And I'll give you a copy of the new CD. Can hang out or whatever. So I went and hung out with them, and we drank some beers. And then I finally had a few beers and got up the courage to say, have you guys made a decision? And he was like, we'll call you tomorrow. And then I just waited all day, and they finally called and said, you got the gig, and
wow,
come to rehearsal tomorrow.
I don't know what the equivalent of that is, because it's not like you were, I don't know, it's not like being in the minor leagues playing for the...
It did feel like that.
It did.
I mean, it did feel like going from the minors to the majors in a lot of ways. I mean, that was like the first time, you know, the Foo Fighters now are in a very different place than the Foo Fighters were in then.
So were there growing pains associated with going from a small van scene to that for you?
Yeah, it was, in some ways, it was kind of lonely to have your own hotel room. It was the first time I'd ever had my own hotel room.
Really?
And, like, I didn't know them at all. So, you know, I'd be like, in no use, we were all in the same hotel room. Right. So you never had to call anybody to go to dinner. You just were all there. Hey, should we go get some dinner? You know, kind of thing. And all of a sudden, I'm in this weird position of, like, I don't know these guys at all, and I'm calling their room, like, what are you guys doing? kind of thing. So it was, you know, it was weird. You know, it took a while to get to know everybody and find my footing, you know. And
you were the third guitar player, right?
I was the third guitar player, yeah.
So how did that bode for your sense of security?
Well, I remember pretty early on, Taylor gave me good advice, you know, and he said something like, you know, you have to make yourself an asset here,
right,
and do something that nobody else is doing, I think is kind of how I interpreted it, you know. But yeah, it was, you don't get like an instruction manual when you join a band like that.
Right.
And we have like, you know, obviously things have grown and it's just gone to places that you would have never even imagined. But I don't want to ever think of it as, I just don't want to take it for granted. You know, bands are not normal jobs. You cannot count on the public caring forever. You know, they're very fragile. You know, it's like your one argument from it all crumbling. I mean, we've all seen what's happened to all our favorite bands over the years.
And sure.
But I feel like in a lot of ways, nowadays, things are you know, better than they've ever been within the band.
Well, I'm curious about the impetus to go and make solo records, because we went to see Merle Haggard in Bakersfield.
Yeah, we did.
I don't know, 5 years ago, 4 years ago, yeah, something like that. And I think at the time, maybe you were just starting to really dive deep into that Bakersfield sound and alternative country and things like that. And I was curious also because the Foo Fighters, like, they couldn't be farther from that. Like, that's the one area I think Foo Fighters don't really touch, is sort of alternative country, you know.
I would sum it up like, in Foo Fighters, I got to play guitars with humbuckers. And in, you know, my solo stuff, I play guitars mostly with single coil pickups.
Now, so, for the audience that has no idea
what I'm talking about.
There's no twang in the Foo Fighters.
Not a lot of twang.
Yeah.
Not a lot of twang. Yeah. And I'd been a fan of you know, alt country or whatever, Americana type stuff for a long time at that point, but I'd never attempted to actually go play it. What I found was, like, you know, because I grew up playing rock and punk rock and things like that, it was not at that time sort of second nature to me to play the stuff that I was listening to. And so when I did that second Dead Peasants record that was all the honky-tonk covers, that was really the idea of that for me. It was just to go do that for a while and just play those songs and play those Buck Owens songs and Merle Haggard songs. And even though we're doing sort of scrappy, rockier versions of them, it was good for me. It made that influence really sink in a different way. And that led to the songs that I wrote for my new record, really being I wasn't trying to write songs that sounded like that. It was just coming out of me.
Right. Well, there's a hard-edged honky-tonk, like, powerful sound on the new record that is more to me, like, when you hear original Buck Owens honky-tonk records, they sound like studio records, and then when you see those kind of bands live, they get a little harder and a little more raucous or full of energy or whatever. And I think what's great about this record you made is it feels so live. Like, there's not a slow ballad or anything on there. Like, it just hits you.
Well, that was on purpose. I mean, I wanted to make a record that was a Saturday night record.
Right.
You know, my first Dead Peasants record, that's way more mellow. And when I went out and played those songs, it wasn't very fun.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
Those are songs that people, you know, kind of mopey. When I did the second Dead Peasants record, all of a sudden, for the first time ever, when I've been doing, you know, my solo stuff, people were dancing and hooting and hollering and having a good time. And it was kind of like, oh, right, these songs are like a celebration.
Yeah.
You know, and I wanted to make a record that was like that, that when I went out and played it live, that it was actually kind of fun.
What do you think really drew you to that honky-tonk thing? Because I remember around that time, you started woodshedding a lot of that stuff.
Well, I was also kind of coming out of a strange period for me as a guitar player where I felt like I had kind of like, I wasn't very inspired for a couple of years, and I felt kind of like I'd stagnated as a player. And so I started taking lessons from some different people. And
see, I think that's so cool that you'd go at this stage in your life and take lessons. And
well, I figured out that for me is that's how I keep it. That's how I keep fresh.
Right.
You know? I love to play guitar all the time. I just love it. You know, and even on these long van rides, I'll just sit in the back seat and I'll just kind of noodle on my guitar. For a couple of years I did kind of lose that, but then since then, it just has ignited something in me that I love it. And you know, when real life starts to happen, when you get married and you have kids and you buy a house and you have a job and stress and all that stuff, I think it's really easy, like, to you sort of stop listening to music the way you did when you're a kid, you know, because you just don't, like, for me, I would just listen to music all the time. I just lay on my bed and I'd put records on and stare at the record sleeve or whatever. But it's not like that now, you know. I don't music is something I listen to in my car or if I'm jogging,
right?
You know what I mean?
Right.
But the rest of the time I'm like answering emails and deal, you know. And you want to be with your kids and your wife, and you want to be like, you know, there for that.
Yeah, of course.
It's just like you just have all this other stuff that sort of comes in. It's just like you lose that sort of innocent fan way of listening to music, and it's, you know, I don't know if it's possible to get that back, but I definitely feel like at the age that I'm at now, and probably working in the music industry has a lot to do with it too. Maybe it's different for people that don't, but like, you know, I'm surrounded by music a lot.
Right.
And sort of the business side of music and all those things that can make you like a jaded old cynical, you know, bastard or whatever. And I think that maybe that affects you too, but it's important to me to keep that sort of fascination with new music that, even if it's not new, it's new to me.
Does it change your playing the Foo Fighters or what you bring to a solo? Or
you probably have to ask those guys that. there was a moment when we were recording a song in Nashville where, you know, I was trying to put a B-Bender track on the song. Dave came in and he's like, no, none of that. Don't put any of that shit on there.
Yeah.
I mean, probably. And I don't know if I would have tried that a few years ago.
No, but I think that that's, you know, I admire
it
that.
It has changed me a lot as a player. It really has. It's changed me a lot.
Well, the record, it has a bite to the guitar licks that are, I'm trying to think of the song. I think it's Better Days.
Yeah, okay.
There's a two-part melody lick. The first one does one figure, and the second one has a little thing on it that I more associate with glam rock solos.
Dude, that is straight Ace Frehley. Ace Frehley lick.
Exactly. Yes. And as much as Honky Tonk has influenced you, I feel like there's also that falling into those songs from your past. And that's, for me, is fun to listen to. And when you told me you were making this record, I walked away and I was like, God, that's pretty amazing. Because people should know that you went to Dave Cobb, who's a legendary Nashville producer. I mean, who has he produced? Give me the...
He's done a lot of records over the years, but, you know, Shooter Jennings, Jamie Johnson, Chris Stapleton, Sturgill Simpson, Jason Isbell, and a whole lot more. I mean, he's
alternative
sort of the
country
in that
people.
World. Yeah.
Right. And so you have this glorious studio in the Valley, the Foo Fighter zone, that you can go to and play and record records pretty much for free.
Yes.
But you decided to go take a hotel in Nashville, live there for I don't know how many weeks.
A month. Three and a half weeks, something like that,
Hire Dave Cobb, go to his studio.
Yeah.
And I walked away going, God, that's really cool. Chris wanted to, like, really make a record right.
Right.
And part of me goes, must be hard on the bad days leading up to that to justify the time and money being spent to go do that.
Yeah, I mean, but you know, here's the thing. I had always produced my own solo stuff.
Right.
You know, or there was just no producer. You know, I guess technically I was the producer on the stuff. And every one of those records I've ever made, when they're done, I always want to go back and change, like, half of it, you know? Or I think, God, that idea really wasn't, you know, fleshed out to where it should have been, and, you know. So there's just sort of a lot of, like, regrets with those records. And I knew for this record, it was just important to me. I wanted to make a record that I could really be, like, 100% proud of. And I'm just such a huge fan of Dave's work, and I just asked him if he would do it, and he said yes, and had some time available, and, you know, going out there and working with a bunch of guys that I didn't know, and I didn't even really know Dave going into it. I had interviewed him once, but that was it. And getting out of town, being 100% out of my comfort zone, was, I just wanted to do it. I wanted to have that experience. I wanted to be able to take my songs as far as I could get them, and then hand them off to somebody that I trusted, who I knew was an amazing producer that could take him to another place. And that's exactly what he did.
And I would think, like, it would bring up all sorts of, like, it'd bring in your self-critic, like, are the songs good enough?
Well, you know,
why am I spending all this
money?
We're
all, like, it's super insecure, right, at heart, you know, especially when it's something, when you're writing songs and trying to sing and stuff, it's like you're very exposed feeling. And going into that situation and not knowing those guys, the first day, I was nervous. I was really nervous because, you know, here's a guy who's made all these amazing records with these guys that are just the best of the best, you know? And I know, like, I have no illusion that I can sing as well as those guys, play as well as those guys, write as well as those guys. But you just had, like, I had to put that out of my mind. But even still, first day, totally nervous.
Did it affect your ability?
Well, I mean, probably, yeah. I mean, I really honestly felt the whole time like I was just trying to keep up with everybody else in the room because we tracked live, you know. But the very first day, you know, with the first song, Dave said, well, you know, what do you want to start with? And I said, oh, why don't we start with Goodnight Little Rock? And he goes, okay, give me a minute. And he runs in the back and he listens to my demo for a few minutes and, like, wraps his head around it. And then he goes, okay, you guys come out, you know. And we go out there, and we're in the big room at Studio A, RCA Studio A.
Where?
Yeah, like Dolly Parton recorded Jolene, and, like, you know, just crazy. Like, again, you have to put those thoughts out of your head, because it would crush you if you thought about it. And he sort of said, hey, we should play the song. What about we did this groove? And we went over on the gear, and we jammed through it a couple times, and then, you know, did it three or four times and got the take. And from that point forward, I was just, you know, okay, this is going to be amazing. You know,
really?
I mean, right away, the first song, it was just, like, I could play you the demos. It's so much better than the songs were when I went out there, you know?
What a great thing.
Yeah.
To give yourself that experience.
Yeah, to work with a really, like A-list producer and incredible talented guys that elevate your ideas. Because that's what they do. You know, they take your little idea and they just make it, you know, infinitely better.
Well, I want to ask you about the lyrical content of the record because, you know, like all good honky-tonk, there's a lot of drinking and drugs and whoring and gambling. And a lot of it feels autobiographical to me. Not from now, but from some point in your life.
Right.
You know, obviously, you can't write a country song about your nanny made you late to your yoga class.
Totally.
So
it's the funny thing. Like, you know, I was thinking about this on the way over here because, I knew I'd sent you the lyrics and stuff. And, like, we've been friends a long time, but, like, most of those things that I'm writing about are predate, you know, our relationship and most of the relationships I have now, you know.
Most
of the
people
I see on a regular basis, like, they don't know that guy, you know. Thankfully, well, kids don't know, but most importantly, my kids don't know that guy.
Until they read the lyric sheets.
Right. Well, I'll tell you a funny story. So I've been out on the road doing some shows. So I got some advance copies of my new record right before I left to go on this tour. And I opened one up, and I was, you know, it's the first time I'd seen it with the artwork and everything, like for real, not on a computer screen. I pull it out, and I leave it on my desk at home. And I leave for tour, and we've got like a long drive to get to Portland. And a couple days later, I'm like in the back of the van, you know, just, I don't know what I was doing. And I get a text from Cara, my wife. And the text is like, and she's going to kill me for saying this in this interview, but I have to tell you the story. The text is like, yeah, I've been reading through the lyric book on your new record, and it looks like you wrote a bunch of songs about us getting in arguments and a bunch of songs about someone that clearly isn't me. I was just like, zing! Oh, no.
Yeah.
Well, you know, it's a tough thing, because if you're going to write, like, real, honest, you know, kind of introspective songs, then, you know, so, some of the songs on the record aren't, like, it's kind of fiction, but it pulls from reality.
That's
you know?
The sense I got. And, right. and I got the sense that some were obviously more autobiographical than others.
Yeah.
But it made me wonder, and I want to get to your podcast, because you talk about, with almost everyone you interview on your podcast, you ask about the songwriting process.
Yeah.
And I know that's something that you're very curious about in other writers, but what I'm curious about with you is being this guy who I don't know, who most of your friends don't know.
Right.
Who apparently your wife doesn't know.
Oh, she knows him.
Now
she knows him.
And having to sort of revisit that to write about it
right.
with this more mature, older perspective, and what that process was like, or what that experience was like for you.
Well, it's an interesting thing, because as when I'm writing lyrics, I am just not drawn to write happy-go-lucky, yay, isn't life great, I love you, baby, kind of songs. I just for whatever reason, what comes out of me is the darker, more sort of, you know, negative side of life. I just think it's more interesting, I guess. And
yeah.
There's one song on there that I felt like I needed to write, you know, kind of a love song for my wife.
And, Still and Better Days.
Yeah, it's the last song on the record. And it was, lyrically, it was the hardest one for me to write. It was the one song that I hadn't really finished before I went out there.
Well, there's still some dark stuff in that one.
Right, totally. Yeah, exactly. It's not exactly a walk in the park, but it is sort of, you know, a little bit more uplifting. But a lot, you know, it's funny. There is like this kind of this phase of this timeline in my life that I tend to draw most of my sort of lyric inspiration from.
What age is that?
It's like kind of my 20s. It's kind of those No Use for Name days, or maybe the early days of being in the foos, you know?
Right.
Yeah, it's tough to talk about, because I don't like, I would never want to come off like, ooh, look at me, I was a total fuck up and I did lots of drugs, and like, I kind of really don't even want my kids to know
the extent of your debauchery.
I wasn't like the worst guy on the block, believe me. There was a lot of people around that were doing a lot worse than I was, but
yeah.
I was like born with a guilty conscience.
What do you mean?
And it just, through all the years of partying and sort of living a certain lifestyle, I sort of felt guilty about it the whole time. There was like, as much as I was having a good time, I could kind of never, I wasn't one of those people that could just be like, fuck it.
Really?
Even if I said that out loud, inside I was kind of toiling on it. You know what I mean? So I kind of had like, I always just had like a darkness internally all through my teenage years and, you know, sort of early adult life. Probably even still now. It's just kind of, I think it's just kind of who I am.
So what was the tipping point that made you kind of change in terms of having to leave that guy behind? Was there a moment? Was it a band-related thing? Was it a wife-related thing?
You know, I always say that getting sober is like probably hurt my career, if anything. You know, in rock and roll, that's not good for you, because I don't hang out late anymore. You know, I'm like the first guy out the back door. You know,
so
back to the hotel.
So being sober is not an asset in the Foo Fighters.
Well, I don't think it's
not an
asset.
Taylor's advice.
I don't think it's an asset in rock and roll. you know? I mean, I was seriously, I'm not even kidding. I think that in the early days, for me, probably a lot of what put me in the right place at the right time for various things was just being the guy willing to stay till the bitter end. you know what I mean?
Right.
I mean, that's the reality of it.
But obviously at some point it didn't work for you anymore.
No, and you know, when we had kids and stuff, you know, it just was not working for me anymore at all.
So
you know, I knew that it was going to be live a certain life and lose my family or get my shit together and get to live with my family.
Right.
You know?
So going back to write about that stuff, is that difficult? Is it, you know, is it cathartic?
I think the biggest difference between rock and roll and country music is the lyrics, you know? Country music tends to be really straightforward storytelling. You know, and rock and roll oftentimes is not. It's a little more, you know, vague.
Myth-making or...
Or just sort of poetic, you know, like right. Just words that sound nice. And there's nothing wrong with that. It's great. I mean, I've written lots of songs like that, too. But I didn't want to do that this time out. I wanted, like, with every song, I really wanted to... I worked on all of them a lot, you know. And sometimes you have, like, lyrical inspiration. You get a bunch of stuff out real fast. But then, you know, for me, I'll go back and refine it and just try to make it as good as I can. And then for a lot of it, you know, I would really just look at my songs and go, what's the point? You know, what am I trying to say here with this? You know, what's the sort of point of this little story? You know, what does it mean?
Does that force honesty? When you get to that point, you're like, no, I have to be more true. I have to tell this story.
Yeah, I mean, this was pointed out to me a long time ago. I actually took a great songwriting workshop from Peter Case, from, you know, that had been.
See, this is what I like about you. Yeah. Well, you go out at age 55 or whatever you are, and you take a songwriting workshop.
Well, I figured
you got the senior discount.
I mean, I'm a huge Peter Case fan.
Yeah,
and I didn't know Peter Case at the time, so I thought, how am I ever going to get in a room with Peter Case? And I didn't have my podcast.
I'll
yet.
Just pay him.
You know what I mean? How am I ever going to check him out and see what he does? And it was great. I loved it because it was like an 8-week songwriting workshop thing where every week you had to write a song. And you know, like most people that write songs, like when there's no deadline, you just don't finish stuff.
See, I think that's so great that because also it's I suppose to the ego a bit humbling to be the guy in the Foo Fighters that's also going to do this.
Well, I'll tell you, it was great because the second class. So the first class, you know, he gives you an assignment and then you come back in and you have to play your crappy little song, you know, in front of all these people that you don't know, and it's just you on a guitar. And so I start playing my song, you know, everyone's going around the room playing their song, and I start playing my song and I'm just like so nervous and I'm strumming loud and singing quiet, and I get like halfway through and he goes, hold on, and he turns to everybody else in the class, he's like, this is a mistake that a lot of people make, you gotta sing louder, play quieter. I was just like, oh, I was so crushed. It was awesome.
Now,
but it was great. I loved it.
You're in that class, I'm sure you're out and you're, you know, people know who you are.
I don't think people knew who I didn't go in there going like, hey, I'm the guy in the Foo Fighters. Like, I know that Peter did not know.
Oh,
until
really?
Until the end, well, I went up and I told him at the very end. And
was like, and he asked for your autograph?
No. He was like, man, tell Pat I said hi.
No kidding.
But anyway, he
tell Pat to get his butt down here for some classes.
Some songwriting classes. No, I don't remember what I was leading to. It was something that he said, some songwriting advice. Oh, I think he, in that class, pointed out that the stuff that people connect to the most is the most specific. You know, it's like those weird little details in songs that you don't know what exactly he's referring to. You know, you left your keys on the table with the Dr. Pepper, whatever, you know, something like, some very specific thing that happened to whoever wrote that song. And that's the stuff that people pick up on the most. So that was what I was trying to do with this batch of songs, just get really sort of specific.
It's true. I think the most general understanding or connection to humans come from the most specific stories.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So we got to talk about this. So you do this podcast.
Yeah.
Walking the Floor. First off, you know, you start it, you're almost a character.
Like, right.
I noticed specifically on the Lucinda Williams one, when you finished your conversation with her, you almost have more of a country accent, southern accent or something, or a Texas. You should go back and listen to the end.
I'm like the Zelig of podcasts.
Yeah, but you know, you started out with Hola, Senores, and Senoritas.
Oh, yeah, sure.
And I just made me wonder if you, like me, have a nostalgia for the days when you really felt like you had a radio DJ, almost like a band you loved. You had somebody on the radio that you tuned into.
Well, you know what I was trying to draw from, and I don't probably even do it enough. I mean, I definitely don't ham it up as much as they do, but I was trying to draw from the guy that does the intro on the Grand Ole Opry.
Okay.
You know
what
I mean? And which is totally that old, exactly what you're talking about, that old-timey, you know, radio personality thing.
Right.
Because when I first started my podcast, I didn't know how to be. You know, I didn't know
what to... It's a funny thing,
right? It is a weird thing. And of course, and then you're like listening back to your own voice. It's terrible.
Yeah.
You know, I've gotten way more comfortable with it now. I used to edit a lot more. And
you
I would
did.
Re-record my questions because I just didn't like how I sounded, you know,
right.
live. Which is, I think, is pretty silly now. But yeah, I definitely wanted it and want it to have a little bit of that old-timey flair in there. And as a matter of fact, it's funny you brought that up because there was a few weeks where I was doing them at home, because, you know, I could just, with a microphone on my laptop, I'd do them anywhere I am.
Right.
But I was doing them, and I would be recording my little intro and outro things in the really early in the morning before I woke my kids up.
Yeah.
So I'd be like, hey, this is Chris Shiflett, it's Walking the Floor time, you know? And like really like laid back and quiet.
The intimate episodes.
And my buddy Davis that helps me, you know, book my podcast and works on it with me, was like, after a few weeks, I was like, dude, what is going on? It's totally lifeless, man. You gotta go back in. I was like, oh, yeah, okay. I shouldn't do it. I shouldn't record them at 6 a.m.
Yeah.
Wait till you've had all your coffee.
Well, they're really interesting because I get the sense that oftentimes your questions are for you.
Yeah.
That you're trying to assimilate this wealth of knowledge through these people you admire.
Well, it's funny because that is exactly right. And what I've learned from doing it for a few years now is that nobody, at least nobody I've ever interviewed, can really clearly articulate how you write songs.
You know, it's funny you say that, because even on the Lucinda Williams one, which I keep going back to because it's fascinating.
It's great.
First off, I got the sense that you really admire her. And so your questions were, you really did want, you know, when you said, tell the audience, you know, if you had to give someone advice on writing.
That's advice for me.
Right.
Yeah, for sure.
But it's exactly what
you
said.
But even with a lot of, because there's artists that you interview like Lucinda Williams or like Merle Haggard, Dwight Yoakam, some of those like people that are icons of music that, you know, of course I want to know how they do what they do. You know, I'm just kind of fascinated by it. But then it's also all the younger artists, because now that we've been doing it for a few years, you know, I'm interviewing all these people who I'm not familiar with their music until I find out I'm interviewing them.
Right.
And then I'm like, oh, cool. Well, now I got to go listen to what they do. And so it just keeps me hearing all this new music all the time.
Yeah.
So I think it's been a huge education for me in a lot of different ways.
Is there something that you didn't expect at all coming out of the podcast?
I think the thing that I learned is once I did a few of the interviews, I just learned how much I liked it. Because as a musician myself who has been, you know, on like lots of promo tours and done this sort of thing a lot, you always wind up, you're in like, you sit in a hotel room all day, you do these quick little interviews, pretty much everybody asks you the exact same thing.
Right.
It gets very canned. It's just stale after like a day, and you have to do that like for your whole life. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So you're just answering the same questions over and over. So one of the driving things that I wanted to do was just not ask the same questions. Because I will read interviews with the people that I'm going to interview, and I'll try to avoid asking those questions. I want to ask people things that they don't normally get to talk about or maybe that they can...
Which,
just
by the way,
relax
with the icons, it's harder to ask them questions they haven't been asked.
Right, exactly. Well, the icons are tough. Like when you interview somebody like Dwight or Merle, somebody that's been around for a long time, has made a lot of records, those are hard because there's just so much there. And you don't want to, you know, you can't sit down with somebody for 3 hours usually.
Right.
And so you just don't, you know, that becomes hard because you're like, well, I want to ask them the right things about the right stuff, you know. That
I'm glad you feel that same pressure as I do.
Well, it's given me a lot more appreciation for people that, you know, journalists and, you know, anybody that does an interview for a living. It can be challenging. Although, honestly, I've never had a bad one. I mean, I've never had one that I walked out of going like, whoa, that sucked. That guy was a dick. You know, like, I almost kind of want that to happen so I can say that it happened once, yeah. You know, because they've all been pretty great.
Right. But what I take away from your podcast is that, yeah, the songwriting process is a mystery. It's a very hard thing to describe.
Yeah.
And maybe the asking the people who do it, maybe they aren't even the best or the most qualified right. person to answer the yeah. question.
Right. I mean, I think that, yeah, there you can never exactly clearly define. I know for me what works, you know, to get ideas down. You know, I just, and even still, it's probably different every single time. But, like, you know, I know that, you know, if I'm just writing a lot and I'm writing every day and I'm always keeping, you know, ideas in a notepad, that's when good ideas come. You know, I just have to be doing it. I have to write.
Right. You can't
I have to
sit
write
down.
Too much. You have to. And this was, you know, I probably again picked this up in that Peter Case thing, because I think I had only ever really written sort of intermittently before then, or when, you know, when I had a bunch of ideas, and then I'd sort of write the lyrics as sort of almost like an afterthought because you had to have some lyrics or whatever. But it wasn't until I think I took that workshop where the idea of, like, no, you just gotta write until the good ideas come. But that's not universal. A lot of people don't do that, you know? I asked John Doe that question. He said, no, I write songs when it's time to write songs.
Well, I think that you're giving yourself this amazing education by doing... Like, was that the unexpected benefit to the podcast?
Yeah, and I think also just, you know, getting to meet all those folks. You know, because
right.
when are you going to get a chance to sit in a room with most of those people and have in-depth conversations about their creative process and, you know, how they've done what they've done?
Right.
Yeah.
Well, I want to close with just a question of sort of, you know, we've been talking about these two lives you're leading, one in Foo Fighters land where, you know, you get your butt wiped for you. And, but, you know, I shouldn't say that. I should say.
No, you can say that. It's pretty much true. It's very comfy, you know?
It is. And you have a writer. You get to put certain items on it. They show up.
Yeah.
Have you questioned the decision to get back in a van and do this tour at all in the last couple weeks?
No van tour. You don't ever escape a van tour without a little bit of drama.
And you're basically paying for the privilege to be there.
Right. Well, yeah, there's that too. I try not to think about that.
Well, see, I think that there's something to that too, to getting to a certain place in your life with Foo Fighters and to be able to go and do this. And I wonder if it makes you think about your kids at all, just in terms of them not just seeing the life of what Foo Fighters is. I mean, is there a lesson in getting in the van at this age?
Well, there definitely is. You know, I hope that my kids see that. I hope that they see, and even, you know, even with Foo Fighters stuff, you know, when when we're working, I always say to my kids, you know, I'm going to work. I don't say I'm going to, you know, the studio or whatever. I say I'm going to work because I want my kids to think that it's work. Even though, like, you know, we all know being in a band's great. It's fun.
But if they all drop out of high school,
ain't gonna happen. That's gonna be military school before that happens.
Really?
See, I think that it's tough. It's gonna be. I mean, I think I'm a pretty nice dad and all that. But it's certainly like I'm gonna be watching them through those difficult years.
You are.
In a way that I don't think my parents, you know, my parents' generation, like, I don't think my parents could relate to how we all were, because my parents, like, they just did what they had to do.
Right.
That generation just did what they had to do. They just went to school. You know, my mom was never going to drop out of school. She was always going to go to college. You know what I mean? It was like, because she wasn't an idiot, you know? So I think when me and my brothers kind of, you know, went that way, I think my mom was, you know, I'm sure she was just like, huh? What are you doing?
But, you know, it's funny. Like, you turned out to have this amazing life, but it also speaks to probably how fortunate and how unpredictable and how improbable
right.
that it was that it turned into this.
And sure. And I think I hope that that's the biggest lesson that my kids take from whatever I've done, is that, you know, it is okay to dream big because, you know, it can happen. Everybody told me I was, you know, everybody in any kind of position of authority, of course, scoffs at the idea, like, I'm going to move to LA, I'm going to make it, you know? And really, there were many points along the way where I scoffed at that idea, too, but,
yeah.
You know, it worked out.
Yeah.
And so, you know, you can have crazy dreams and actually get there. And really, in a lot of ways, you know, what my life has become, I could have never dreamt.
No. I think what you've done with your life and the fact that you've, in your most successful years, you have maintained, like, a passion or an interest or a discovery or a curiosity about music through making solo records, through doing your podcast, that, I mean, it's really admirable, and it's really something that it says a lot about you as not only a creative person, but just as someone who doesn't want to rest on his laurels. Mm. And it's inspiring. And so I'm glad we got to talk about it.
Absolutely. This was really fun.
Yeah. Now we can go back to the skate park.
Yeah. Well, I was going to say, you haven't been to the Lucky Ramp for a while.
I know.
Yeah.
I think the last time I was at the Lucky Ramp, I nearly got a branch in my eye.
That's still an issue.
Well, folks, that's our show for today. Thanks for listening, and be sure to go check out Chris's podcast, Walking the Floor. It is a deep dive into alt country, punk rock, and traditional country songwriting that you will love. Also, check out Chris's new record, West Coast Town. And hey, if you're already a fan of Chris, you may want to head over to the off-camera store and get a limited edition signed copy of the Chris Shiflett off-camera magazine. That's right, Chris came by the studio, he signed some magazines for us, and not only is it a great way to have a limited edition keepsake, but it also supports off-camera, so it's a win-win. And while you're there, subscribe to the show. We've got a great app, we've got a way to watch full shows online by buying a monthly subscription, and we have our aforementioned store, where you can get the limited edition off-camera magazine, either on an a la carte basis or on a 12-issue subscription. It's a great way to show your coffee table some love and support the show. So go to offcamera.com and check it all out. If you want to drop me a line, I'm sam@offcamera.com. And if you want to find us on social media, I'm Sam Jones Pictures on Instagram, Sam Jones on Twitter, and we are Off Camera Show on Twitter and Instagram. So that's just about every way in the world you can get in touch with us. So don't be shy, drop us a line. I want to thank Nathan Shields, Michaela Galvin, Crawford Shippey, Laura Kemper, Amy Jones, Matthew Davidson, Justin Kennedy, and Cara Johnson for all the hard work they do on the show. And be sure to join me next time when I sit down with stage and screen actor Billy Crudup.
You know, I've had moments on stage where every second seems to last forever because you're so hyper aware of being the agent of some kind of creative expression that people are receiving. When that connection happens, it's a vivid kind of living. The world is on fire.
When a little film like Almost Famous thrust him into the next leading man status, he shares some of the most inspiring and humbling moments of his career. Stories from his roles in films like Without Limits, Rudderless, and Spotlight, and the play that taught him what kind of an actor he really was. See you next time, off camera.